Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hello and welcome to the Dork Forest. It's me, Jackie Cation. DorkForest.com, TheDorkForest.com. If you enjoy a determiner, let's talk about the credits. The song written, composed, and sang by Mike Rickberg with his wife now. She wasn't when we first started 19 years ago, Sarah Cohen. That's right. Patrick Brady is doing all the tech. He does the audio and the video, and he puts it all together, and he's awesome. Vilmos is doing JackieCationStore.com, and thank you very much, Vilmos. The rest of it's on Squarespace, including DorkForest.com and TheDorkForest.com, which I just integrated into JackieCation.com. Also there, merch. There's Dork Forest t-shirts. There's all my stand-up merch, a new t-shirt and beanies, and also CDs and DVDs. If you own those devices, feel free to empty my garage. You knock yourselves out. You can see videos of different stand-up shows that I've done on the television, and you can watch a couple of my specials. Always fun. I have another podcast, The Jackie and Laurie Show, just about stand-up, but The Dork Forest is the flagship. 19th year, we're doing it. You can go to my Bandcamp. You can go to YouTube, where the videos of The Dork Forest are all hanging out, and there's a bunch of stand-up stuff as well. It is November or December of 2024, so I ask that you do not donate to the Dork Forest in these 2 months. Instead, you find a food bank in your town near to you and help out somebody in November and December. You can use feedingamerica.org, or you can Google the words food bank and your zip code, and a food bank will come up. I'm sure there's other things that I should be talking about. Come and see me do stand-up in November and December. Holy smokes, I'm everywhere. And JackieCation.com has all those tour dates. But who's going to dork out? Let's find out now.
Jackie Cation here, shouting into the internet. So Patrick Brady has a project. I'm so sorry, Patrick. My headphones aren't working. I don't know. My microphone, external. I'm in Michigan. Let's blame it on the weather, because it's been raining. What? It's been rain, sleeting, snowing. It's a wintry mix. You guys, I'm here with Sam Pasternak. He's got a new novel out, and I'm excited to dork out with him. But Sam Pasternak is Sam Pasternak all over the place. You were to want to follow Sam Pasternak on the interwebs, you would go S-A-M-P-A-S-T-E-R-N-A-C-K, and then that's how you would find Sam Pasternak. Welcome to the show, Sam. How's it going?
I like that you like a little bit turn into like the oh, I'm talking to a novelist. We're going to go like intellectual for a half second.
Just for a half second. Finished a novel, you guys. I have always wanted to have written a novel. Let's just say that.
To have written a novel. Yes.
Yes. You know what? I understand it's a great deal of work. stand-up comedy, it's just with the bit, and then you figure it out, and then all of a sudden you have six albums.
Which is a beautiful thing. I'm not mad at that at all. For this took me about 7 months to write, which I assume is like a single road tour for you, or like less than that. I mean,
what? 7 months? That's certainly a third of the amount of time at least that I take to write a new album. So probably because I'm not sitting down working on it. Instead, I'm standing up going, is this something? And then we go forth, but that is, but it's called Walker, and it's a novel. Is it now? Here's the thing: I was not sent an advance copy. Don't send me an advance copy, anybody, ever, because I will buy the book if I want to read the book. I promise you, I'll buy it. Walker, it's a novel. Is it like? Is it an Oprah slice of life business? Is it a mystery? Is it a romance novel? What are we talking about?
So the great thing about this will lead into what my dorkdom is. But yes. it's basically a road novel. It's a mystery and it's a comedy. So it's a blend of
what is a road novel?
You know those novels where someone's just like going somewhere. Someone's just like taking a little road trip. It's one of those. So I it's like.
So Bing Crosby, Bob Hope.
Uh-huh.
Oh, really? Oh, my God. I was kidding. All right.
It's we're not, they're not traveling around Europe, or I wrote to Europe, wrote to Secaucus. I forget what the other one. But yeah, no, this is one young man and his second cousin walking across the country, in the storied history of pedestrianism, which I know will be.
That's right. And the reason you've written this novel is because you enjoy something called pedestrianism. Do you do pedestrianism?
Not at all. No, I do not have the endurance.
Hilarious.
or the illogical nature to my brain to want to walk the way that these pedestrians walk.
And let me just say, that is the perfect dorkdom, because it's something that you're like, this is amazing. It's how I like breakdancing. It's I can't breakdance, but look how cool the X Games is.
Exactly. It's an appreciation of that. So pedestrianism essentially was the X Games of the Civil War era.
Oh, my God. Wow. Yeah. So really?
Basically, okay. The way it works. Yeah, I can run you through exactly what this is, because this is a nonsensical thing, and I'll explain how I got into it too. So I've always been an incredibly passionate sports fan and played sports as a kid and loved really esoteric, strange sports. So there was a sport that was super popular in the early 2000s called slam ball. Jackie, do you remember slam ball?
I missed a window. What is slam ball?
Slam ball is basketball on trampolines. It was a contact sport. Oh, people were jumping in the air and trying to knock each other over while they were playing basketball on trampolines. It was so intense. Contact sport. Loved it. Loved all like the eating competitions as a kid, the hot dog eating contest and major league eating, and European handball, which is a big Olympic sport still. All these sports that are not super popular at all, then definitely not
they're
too
niche,
popular.
They're niche sports.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So I grew up loving niche sports in addition to following basketball and football and everything else. So my younger brother, Jesse Pasternak, he is aware of my obsession with these niche sports, and he is a massive reader and is constantly walking around with like 5 to 10 books, just like even as an adult man,
like cartoonishly.
Yes, exactly. Like they're always like wobbling around, and he reads everything. He's a massive, massive reader, and so he spends a lot of time when we were kids. He would spend a lot of time in our public library, and he found a book about an esoteric sport called pedestrianism, and he read the first chapter of the book. He closed that book and then he handed it to me and he said, you need to read this book immediately.
Okay. And
so
he never finished it.
And never finished it.
But this sounds, and this is your younger brother. Okay. This sounds
younger
like a very
brother, yeah.
Kind of event. Yeah. Well played, yeah. Jesse Pasternak. Yeah.
So
okay,
he set me up. And so he hands me this book. I read the first chapter of this book. It's called Pedestrianism. It's by a man named Matthew Algeo, I believe, or Algeo is his name, A-L-G-E-O. I read the first chapter of this book. I close the book after the first chapter also. And it took me so long to open it again because I immediately just started Googling, what is this? I'm obsessed with this. The first story in it was so compelling that I was so floored by it that I immediately started looking up a million things and then writing myself based on what I had just read.
And it literally, is it nonfiction? Is it just sort of, when did Mr. Algeo or write it?
I think he wrote it I'm gonna look this up and within the next 5 seconds,
what was the name of the book again?
The book is called, I have it. It's called Pedestrianism, When Watching People Walk Was America's Favorite Spectator Sport. It was written in 2017.
Okay.
And so it's relatively recent.
Yeah.
I read it in 2017 when it came out. No, actually, this must be a later copy. It has to be. Yes, this is the paperback. Excuse me. It was written before then, sometime before 2017, because I read it in 2016. And became absolutely obsessed with it. So basically what pedestrianism is, it is long distance walking. You cannot run. You have to have it's called the
heel. There's rules.
There's rules. There's basically a single rule, which is it's called the heel toe rule. You have to have either one heel or one toe on the ground at all times. So they don't want to see like that photo of Secretariat where all four of Secretariat's legs are off of the ground because she was running so fast.
You cannot be a horse. Step one. No horses allowed. So that you can win. And is it competitive?
It is competitive. So the way that it started was there was a man named Edward Payson Weston. Edward Payson Weston was and I'm going to say I am not an academic on the subject. I am a fan.
This is enthusiasm.
Yes, exactly. So if there are any massive pedestrian heads that are listening to this and I bungle a fact, forgive me.
You're like, please God, let there be.
I just want a friend.
That'd be so great. Just a friend.
So there was this man named Edward Payson Weston, and this began because, as most great things do, he was in severe gambling debt. He needed to get out of his gambling debts, and he bet people that he could walk from Boston to Washington, D.C.
Leaving his creditors behind.
Exactly.
Let me invent something that involves me leaving town.
It was an incredible way for him to sneakily get out of town, but do it
possible. Yeah, I'm not running. You'll know exactly where I am. Anyway, we'll talk about this when I get back.
So
he bet people that he could walk from, what is it, to DC? From where?
From Boston. So he did this massive, massive walk down the Northeast corridor, essentially. And as he was doing this walk, there was no spectator sports in America at the time. It was baseball hadn't taken off, basketball, football. There was no gathering to watch American sport, humans participating in American sport. And so Edward Payson Weston started this walk, and it was a true word of mouth situation where people were like, you hear about this guy? And I'm sure he called the papers too, because he wanted fame and fortune and all of these things. But people would go, you hear about this guy? He's going to be walking through town today. And people would gather on the side of the road. Like a parade. And they would watch a single man in a top hat and a tuxedo and tie and tails, the whole nines, walk down the street. And that was it.
And that's it. So he would walk what? I mean, did he stop walking? Did he get housing at night?
Occasionally he would have housing at night. And there were inns along the way. When it became a competitive sport, they had all these different stipulations where they said, okay, we're going to stop here, or we're going to stop here. These are the agreements that are going to be made. But he was the first one to do this. He became famous for popularizing a bunch of things, popularizing the sport initially. He had a catchphrase.
Branding.
And he had an enemy. And that was what the catchphrase was based on. His enemy was dogs. Dogs would chase him in the streets, and he couldn't.
Yes,
he couldn't run.
There wasn't. I don't know if a lot of people know this. Fences weren't invented until easily 1880, and so have you ever been chased by a dog? I've been chased by a pack of tiny chihuahuas, and it was I told them it was when remember that game that everybody was playing? Words with Friends. I told the dogs, I'm going to have words with dogs. If you guys don't get away from me, I'm going to have to kick a dog because they were nipping at my heels and stuff.
I have been chased by a dog I've been chased by a dog once that is seared into my mind. Once like slightly chased by a Doberman, C-H-A-S-T-E, very C-H-A-S-E-D, by a German Shepherd that was huge and was bounding around my neighborhood. I had to have been like 10 at the time. And it is a fear that has been seared into my mind more than any other fear that I have is being chased by a dog in that way. Right. And I've also, I was bitten by a bat when I was a kid. That did not scare me. Yeah. I was in Connecticut, in suburban Connecticut, and my parents found a bite on my leg.
Did you see Morbius?
No, I did not, but I'm familiar with the character.
It was the character is fascinating. The movie was a disaster. Trailer initially said that he had sonar powers. Mm-hmm. In the later trailer, they dumbed it down and they said that he had like some sort of bat radar, which by definition is a sonar.
Yep.
And so you did not turn into Morbius when you were bit. That's
do we think that the sonar people sued Sony and said, please don't use please don't use our technology in this?
No, I think that there was a dum-dum who was like, what is it? Is it like radar? And people don't know that. And you're like, if you continue to dumb down your writing for humans, people will become dumber. And those who are not dumb are going to become furious. Now, this is one of the great things about the Dork Forest is that you don't get to talk about the thing you get to talk about because I interrupt with a story. Please. And here it's about to happen, Sam Pasternak.
I love it.
pedestrianism will be revisited momentarily. Just to tell you that we now have two dogs and a cat because of my mother-in-law brought a dog and a cat into the world, and she didn't birth them, but she brought them into our home. And we had a tiny dog as well. So I was walking Gordy and Tyson the other morning. This is, I don't know, last week. And as I walk out the door with them on leash, three galumphing huskies, loose, not on, padum, 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 start running towards me just from the end of the street. And I was like, back in the house.
Because
I don't know how dogs meet each other and don't kill each other. And I guess, want to learn. So I come back into the house. Andy, who is my husband, has grown up around so many animals and dogs that he just looked out and he was like, well, they have collars. Give me one of the leashes. And so I give him one of the leashes and I hear him. He walks out of the house and I just hear him go, look at you good boys. And they're just milling around the front door. Look at you good boys. And he clips one of them. And it's the older one. The other two, it turns out it was a mama dog and two giant puppies. And he walks them all into our backyard. And then he spends 4 hours trying to find out who owns these dogs.
Oh, my God.
And eventually cannot find out through Nextdoor and Facebook. And he can't find out through technological terms. So he puts the leash back on the mama dog. And he's just going to walk the dog a block over and knock on doors. So he clips the dog, takes her out of our fence, and is walking away. The two pups are whining and barking and then sail over our fence. And that is how they clearly escape their own yard. And Andy ends up finding the owner of the dogs. He's two blocks away. He's in this weird house that has one of those big cyclone fence. Like he just has a big sort of regular fence, like a metal fence, but it has tarps covering it.
Oh, God.
So he ends up, one of the neighbors of him says, those dogs belong to that guy. So Andy goes up and the dogs are like, hey, this is where we live. And he opens the fence, they go in. And the guy's there and the guy wants to give Andy money. And he's like, I would hope someone would do this for our dogs. And the guy's like, can I give you a hug? And the guy hugs him. And then it turns out all those tarps, the guy is running sort of a used car lot. Welcome to Los Angeles, on his front yard. And so the guy goes, you need a used car. You come to me. And that's that story about dogs and being chased by dogs. So,
I have two questions about this story. One is just a comment. I love that Andy got these dogs into your house by flirting with them, essentially.
You boys.
You some good boys. Come in our backyard for 4 hours. But I want to know, Gordy and Tyson, where the names came from. Did you get, was that you guys or did that?
They were Gordy came to us named Gordy.
Okay. Is that a Michigander thing? Because a Gordy Howe thing, or is it just a dog named Gordy?
Just at the pound. Okay. It's going to get. For some reason, Gordy landed on his feet. We're not going to say he didn't, because Gordy was nine when we adopted him 3 years ago, first dog ever. And they had two dogs and they had to get rid of one for some reason. And Gordy was the one they got rid of. And Gordy is a little bit of a pill sometimes, but it makes me sad that anyone would say, well, I guess I could just get rid of one dog.
Did someone Sophie's Choice the dogs and say
the dogs? I have like, come on, man. And then Tyson was Chris's dog, and they got Tyson as a tiny pup at the pound up in the middle of California. And the pound had named him Tyson. And Chris was always like, I can't believe we kept that name. He was a puppy. He wouldn't have cared, but Fran liked it. And so that's how those names. And then the cat's name, Chris got to name that cat. So she shouldn't have been in charge of naming the dogs either, because the cat's name, Tigger.
I see.
It's not a huge, unique cat name when it comes to cats. So she might have named Tyson Bark or Ruff. I mean, it could have just been, I don't know what Chris would have named.
An onomatopoetic
Tyson.
Name.
She's like, hey, doggo. Come here, doggo.
This is my dog.
This is my dog, doggo. Come here, doggo.
Oh, my God. Well, yes, I have been chased by a dog and it was terrifying. I don't remember the name of this German Shepherd, and I hope I never see it again.
Right. And the German Shepherd did not kill you. See, I used to do door to door sales, in college, right before college. I did door to door for Wisconsin's Environmental Decade, and environmental group. Cool. And, excuse me. And one of the things I would always do as I walked up to different houses is I would just whistle for the dog, because I was like, I would like to see where the dogs are.
Yeah. So present yourselves.
I did all the sort of the farmland outside of, and I like those farm walks, which is.
Where in Wisconsin are you from?
A little factory town outside of Milwaukee called South Milwaukee. And and so the dogs, though, they would not leave. There weren't any fences. And I remember just dogs being right there on the edge. And then here would come the farmer strolling up going, what do you want? See, I got a dog. And I'd be like, well, I'm with Wisconsin. My name's Jackie. I'm with Wisconsin's Environmental Decade. And he's like, yeah, no. And so.
At least he wouldn't go, hey, sick 'em.
Get her. And so I used to be good with dogs, but Andy's amazing. I mean, he will just, because you should just stand. You sort of stand your ground, not with a gun, but just sort of stand there and wait for the dogs to get to know you. And because if you run, they love chasing things.
Yes. And this is what would happen to Weston, which I promise I'm going to circle back to that in a second, but I need to just do one quick Wisconsin question.
Oh, fair enough.
Were the Green Bay Packers ever a part of your life or the lives of those around you?
They're the lives of everyone around me. They are not a part of my life on purpose. I know things about the Green Bay Packers that I don't know. Sam, do you know that they're the only football team that's owned by the town?
I am one of the owners. I oh bought a share.
ending show. No. I don't mind. I end up watching the Green Bay Packers if they're on, going, well, I hope they win. Because I don't care.
For someone in your life. Yeah, no, if it's not a part of your ecosystem. Yeah.
There's names I know. Brett Favre, Aaron Rodgers, some kid named Love.
Yep.
These are things that I know. I have told the story before on the Dork Forest is I went to probably, I think it was my 70th high school reunion. I can't remember. But I walk in and it's in South Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is a small factory town in between Milwaukee and Lake Racine. It's just called South Milwaukee. It's not the south side of Milwaukee. whatever. I walk into the dive bar where we were all weaned as children. And that's where we're having our reunion. And one room has all the steam table food, and the other room is the dive bar that we all sucked on the teat of, or whatever, or one of the many. And so I walk into the dive bar part of it to get a soda. And there is a woman I went to college with, high school with, who is wearing, you know, it's a fancy event, a reunion. She's wearing her good uniform, the good jersey. Like, and it's a fancy football jersey put out by the NFL. So it's clearly like hundreds of dollars, I'm sure.
It's for the Mitchell and Ness classic, probably.
Sure. And it says Matthews on the back of it.
Yep.
And she's standing next to a guy who is her husband, who's also, they're wearing matchy.
Oh, boy.
And it says Matthews. And she turns and says, hey. And I said, your last name isn't Matthews. The silence in the bar is that silence that I'm sure people got before tar was being heated up and feathers were being plucked. And I said, just tell me who he is. I take it he's the guy. And they're like, his name is Matthews. He's a football player and he's very handsome. And I was like, okay, good. Now we all know.
Long hair. I'm glad they didn't do like the what they did to Jazzy Jeff on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and just like toss you out the door. Like that feels like.
We were moments from it.
I only ask because my dad grew up in an area of Brooklyn that was at the time one of the highest concentration of Packers fans in the world, because so random, deep Brooklyn, Mill Basin, blue collar Jewish and Italian Brooklyn, which it's where the movie Anora that just came out is based in that area now. My dad grew up a few doors down from the Lombardis, Vince Lombardi, the great coach who the trophy is named after. And so, Vince Lombardi's brother was the butcher that they would all go to. It was like this small town Brooklyn thing. So they all became Packers fans. It was this massive tradition there. And so I grew up with that tradition. And so anytime I meet someone from Wisconsin, I need to know their relationship to the Packers, because usually it is either really, really negative or really, really positive. And it always fascinates
me. It is never negative. It's
You're
funny
the most
because
apathetic to the Packers, I think, of any Wisconsinite I've ever spoken to.
Oh, and my gosh. It's my brother bought those so you can pretend to own them. Yeah. His sons both own stock. My sister has taken her son to games because she enjoys all sports. But I remember as a kid, very distinct memory as a child, because my father's a big gambler. The joke is that he's not good at it, but he's also not bad at it. We always lived indoors. I always wanted a bike. So
you would have been a great pedestrian.
Oh, I was an amazing pedestrian. We will eventually get to it. And but he, when I think one of my brother Scott, probably because he doesn't talk to my dad anymore, but because my dad could be a little brutal with his mouth. And but he said, did we win today? And he was talking about the Packers. And my dad goes, I'm sorry, do you own the team? And are you making any money off the team? And it was this long diatribe about the people who actually own the team were actually gaining financially from that team. And my father, as a terrible gambler, was not gaining financially and probably had lost. And every year in the 70s, when I was a child, I remember the entire town, it was a murmur throughout the town that would just be like, well, this is a year. Don't you think this is a year? This is probably the year. It's probably the year. And it would just be this weird lit. I would just hear it everywhere. And I'd be like, it's not the year. I don't know what you people. Why do you think it has anything to do with the numbers 1974 or 1982? I don't know why you think. Anyway, so.
I love the idea of you being the arbiter of that, too, that you wake up in like 1998 and you're like, you wake up on January 1st and you're like, oh, this is it. This is the year.
Do I have to hear this again? The world. Again with this year business. I don't think this is
we've been on the season ticket waiting list since 1993. And we're supposed to get the tickets within the next 5 to 7 years. It is truly one of the silliest things in my life is
right. The waiting,
my dad is obsessed with this team, and then he's obsessed with a very minor league, soccer team in, England that is, it's like, it's now they're in the same league as Wrexham, which people know because of Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. But he's obsessed with this other tiny, tiny little team. And so I guess that's where I got my little esoteric sports thing from, because we didn't grow up in Green Bay.
No. And it's, I don't know. I just know that the first time I realized the betrayal was the Brett Favre saying that he didn't want to be on the team anymore, but then retiring, but not retiring. And I think he's currently unretired again, working for some other team. And yet all I know about him was that he stole a bunch of money.
Yes, he did.
From some children, I think.
It was a welfare fraud case. And it was, I have learned so much in the world of football to never actively try to learn too much about the guys who are on your team.
You don't want to. Well, the thing is, they hit their head so much,
exactly.
And they're. It's like being shocked when you find out that professional wrestlers and boxers beat their children's and their wives. You're like, no, they hit people.
That's their job thing. Is hitting people. They're just doing it wrong right now.
That's how they process probably all of their emotions. And in Wisconsin, the town that I'm from just put up a statue to a very famous wrestler from the 70s.
Oh,
and
wow.
I say the word famous, the Crusher. There's a statue of the Crusher in downtown South Milwaukee. And South Milwaukee isn't that small of a town. I always thought of it as a very small town because I used to walk the length and breadth of it, much like Brigadoon, hoping that I could get out of it one day.
Yeah.
And it took 100 years, and then there was a weekend. And and I go back and I'm very nostalgic. And my sister, weirdly enough, is like, I can't believe you have any nostalgia for South Milwaukee. Can't you see what this town needs, which is a match and some sort of propellant? She's not particularly nostalgic.
Your sister, the arson. She's not nostalgic for arsonry. That's fine.
She's just in case anybody needed an idea. So she's like on the board for the Roosevelt Institute now.
Incredible. Incredible.
So she's a good person.
Where all arsons should be.
We all have secret or nightmares of things that would like to be over. And in many cases, it's our childhood. So the walking.
Yes.
Let's talk about Mr. Weston and his dog love at 12.
Yes. So oh my God, I'll go fast. He used to shout, "Damn these dogs, they are my bane," became a popular phrase back in the day. He then did this walk, became incredibly celebrated, and then it became a sport. And there was, a bricklayer, an Irish-American bricklayer who was also slowly started to get into the walking game. And they had a massive, massive event where they walked from Washington, D.C. to Chicago. It was like the Frazier and Ali. It was like a huge, huge match. And so it was the two of them. It was early days of pedestrianism. They walked, again, top hat, ties, tuxedos, tails, while they were drinking milk and eating mutton. And one of them played the trumpet while they were walking, whiskey drinking. It was not the healthiest way to conduct themselves during a sport, but people didn't know back then. And so they would walk from, they did this massive, massive walk to Chicago, and Weston lost. Spoiler alert for not my book, which is fiction, but for the history of pedestrianism. Weston loses this walk. He then, so embarrassed to lose, even though he's essentially the king of pedestrianism at this point, after he basically invents the sport, leaves to the UK, flees to Europe, becomes, and people are like, what's going to happen to him there? He's just going to fade into obscurity. Makes pedestrianism the most popular sport in the UK in the 1870s and 1880s. They create in the US and in the UK these pedestrian halls. So people would go and watch them go around 500 times around a track until someone dropped or finished their laps. It was unbelievable. It was this crazy sport.
You just went and watched laps eventually.
People would, yeah. And so
it was what are the rules? Yeah. You have
the
to dress
rule,
up.
The only rule, you're dressing up in a tuxedo and you can't let both of your feet leave the ground at the same time. And those are the only rules, unless they had different stipulations where it would be, okay, well, we're going to stop at this inn to take a break if it was a long distance one that was outside of the indoor stadiums. And it was the first time too, where there was a drug scandal in sports, a performance enhancing drug scandal. And it was Edward Payson Weston who was busted for eating coca leaves. So cocaine vibes.
Yeah.
And was trying to keep his endurance up by chewing on coca leaves while he was walking, and was then ostracized from the sport, and then made a tremendous comeback in the U.S. again. He came back and did another race against this guy. I think he lost again, if I'm remembering correctly. And then ended up dying relatively young because he was hit by a trolley. He was not watching when he was crossing the street.
Oh, my gosh.
Walking he died doing what he loved.
Or still running from his creditors. Exactly. It's so interesting to me that him and the other guy walking from DC to Chicago.
Yes.
They are I assume they leave together.
Yes.
The race starts.
Yes.
And then they walk.
Yes.
And then they stay at the same inn.
Presumably, that's me on the fandom thing. That's what they've said, like, from what I've read. Yes.
The thing is it feels like it's not really. I mean, I wonder where the race part of it, and you don't have to know. I'm just curious because where the race part of it comes in, because you're like, well, we're gonna leave at like six, you know, with the first light. Let's say that's 5:30 in the morning, and then I'm going to pack a mutton sandwich so that I have something to eat during the day. And then somebody, I might run into a cow and his owner and her owner.
Or it's like a marathon, people just standing there with jugs of milk and you're just guzzling as you go. Oh,
right. And then keep going. Yep. And was there talk of how long it would take? Like, were they like, or were they just, was it the novelty of the watching?
It was, well, for the fans, it was the novelty of the watching, and it was the idea, the whole theme of the sport and the theme of a lot of sports still today, but it's the limit of the human physical form. And so what is the limit endurance wise, I guess is the best way to phrase what this was. So when you're walking, like I'm in Manhattan right now, if I was going to walk somewhere between 50 and 90 blocks, there would be a point where I would stop. Put my hands on my knees and go, "Oy vey, I don't do this anymore."
Like, right, is there a cab?
Exactly. And so that's them. Is the moments of mental toughness, and also physically, it would tear up their feet. I mean, as you can imagine, like, they didn't have the right shoes back then either. They weren't wearing leather shoes.
Yeah. Right. They're just wearing dress shoes.
Exactly.
And you're like, are you going to a ball after this? Were you hoping to dance? It's interesting. So in Europe, when he brought it to Europe, when he brought it to the UK, were the walkers also dressed up? Was it the pedestrian? And but they turned it into a sport that was in an auditorium of some sort or in some sort of track.
Yes, yes. And so they did in the US as well. And so when Preston and the bricklayer, whose name I'm forgetting, had their the Irish American had their big bout after the Washington to DC one. They had a rematch, and that was an indoor one as well. The fascinating thing to me about the indoor ones is that none of those halls, none of those arenas that existed back then exist today, except for one in the UK. There's still one that exists, and I had a friend recently who happened to be driving by it and took a photo for me because they.
Nice.
This is the thing that you've been that inspired this book you've been writing.
It's the Colosseum of pedestrianism, and it's in the middle of Hampshire.
Really was. It was for me. I don't know UK geography that well, but it truly looked like it was in the middle of just a random town. And it was the only one that's still standing, because I guess it's the only one that people are like, oh, we're not going to knock this down. What are we going to put there?
There
is evidence that this sport existed, and it was a wild thing, and it evolved over time into modern race walking, which still exists and is an Olympic sport, but has its roots in pedestrianism from you know.
Have you watched any race walking? I've only seen it in the Olympics.
I've seen a little bit in the Olympics, and I'm familiar with some race walking culture. I will say there's a race walking podcast that exists. It's a little more vibrant in different parts of the world, in different countries. Okay. But I'm slowly dipping my toe into the culture a little bit because of, I'm going to hold it up so you can see my book with all the balloons on it.
It's got balloons. Both of their feet are off the ground there. That cannot be.
Well, when they're in the balloon, yes. The little man with the shadow here is our little walker, who's still on the ground. But the book itself is essentially the imagined scenario where there's the, basically, when I read the first chapter of this book and I closed it, I couldn't stop thinking about what the modern day descendants of these great pedestrians would have thought of their ancestors. What Walker is about is essentially the descendant of an Edward Payson Weston type, the LeBron James of pedestrianism. And him reckoning with this legacy. He's obsessed with pedestrianism and decides to walk across the country when he discovers that he has other relatives all over the country that he didn't know about. He's in his 30s or late 20s, early 30s, and he doesn't know. He discovers he's got all of these relatives who are descendants of the great pedestrian who he's obsessed with. And so,
right, because Weston, while he walked through, would take an occasional break to meet the ladies.
in my fictional world, exactly, or sure, or yeah. So,
right, well, because he's famous, right?
This is a famous man. This is in my version. Preston Dilettante in the book is a famous man who was walking through, and he's a one man parade. He's a one-man parade walking through, and people want to meet.
When is your novel? Is it set current day?
Modern day. Yep. It's set current day, and so there's cell phones and social media. But Walker grew up in the middle of nowhere, unincorporated Idaho, Schnorr's Idaho, deep, deep North Idaho, with his grandfather. And
is it over by Hope? No, I'm kidding. I do stand-up comedy in very rural areas.
I hear you. If you ever make it to Schnorr's, Idaho, it's unincorporated, and I don't believe that there are many, if any, residents, from what I've gathered in my research. But it's this character who grows up in the middle of nowhere and discovers from his grandfather, who he lives with, when his grandfather decides it's the right time to tell him that he has relatives all over the country who are descendants of the man who he's obsessed with, and he wants to know if these other people are as enthralled with Preston's work and his legacy as he is. And as he goes on this walk, he discovers that some people care as much or more or less, and you meet the people in your family who have these common threads and completely disparate upbringings. So it's he walks from Idaho to LA and then LA all the way across the Southwest and the South to Washington, D.C. And that's
the journey of the story. Yeah.
That's the journey of the story. And every single inch of the story has been Google mapped and Google Earthed so that every single step he takes, I know where he is. I know what signs he's seeing, and I know where he's going. So
this is something you can do. I just finished rereading. Actually, I have not read the third book again, but I don't know if you ever read C.S. Lewis's space trilogy.
No.
But it is science fiction, but it's more fantasy than science fiction because the science is non-existent. Because it turns out that C.S. Lewis was a philologist, not a practical scientist. So it's all about, it's essentially about our character is a philologist. So he's the study of languages, and he ends up being kidnapped and taken to Mars. In 1946, this was published. Mm-hmm. And it turns out C.S. Lewis knows nothing about space travel and has... And it actually has the guts to make fun of H.G. Wells, because it published in 1946. And he does do a disclaimer in the beginning saying, I appreciate H.G. Wells a great deal. I'm just saying that my character is making fun of H.G. Wells because he doesn't understand science. And then his spaceship in Out of the Silent Planet, the first of the trilogy, as far as I can tell, the science of his spaceship is if it's shaped like round like the Earth, it must have gravity and air.
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Anyway, so
holy in smokes. Other news.
In other yep. news, they somehow make it to Mars anyway. And
they all immediately get off the ship and it's like, dead.
Spoiler alert. That's exactly what happens at the end of the book.
Okay. Oh, geez.
It's because the angel who is the head of it's the out of the silent planet and Paralandra and that hideous strike. That's the space trilogy. Is actually the best defense of not Christianity, but Christianity, because it's C.S. Lewis and he was a big Christianity guy. Mm-hmm. But the first two books are Old Testament. So it's the best definition of, let us say, Genesis and the origin story that has that was created by so many people.
Yeah,
and, yeah, and but it's tight. You guys, instead of reading the Old Testament, you get yourself a copy of the Space Trilogy by C.S. Lewis. That's more entertaining. It's very interesting, and don't follow the science.
I just had a book event at, I'm in the middle of my book tour right now and I'm bopping around. I was in New York, then LA.
Dan Pastrnak, not related, wrote books as well. We'll talk to
yes.
him later.
Yeah,
Sam
yeah.
Pastrnak, spelled just like you would think, has written a book called Walker, and you could follow him all over the place and you can go buy the book, by the way, just so everybody knows. It'll be in the notes.
It's on bookshop.org and Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the places where you can get books. And especially bookshop.org, you could use to get at any of your indie bookstores. It's like a really cool process to do that.
Bookshop.org. Yes.
Bookshop.org. And so I'm in the middle of this book tour right now. And I did an event, a hometown event. I went to my hometown in Irvington, New York, and did an event at the local public library, which is where my brother found the pedestrianism book that inspired me so much in the first place. And so my brother, who he writes for Filmmaker Magazine and he moderates a lot of Q&A. So he was the moderator. The two of us did like a two brothers coming
excellent.
Home.
Excellent.
And two pillars of our community came to the event. One was my high school Latin teacher, Michelle Sella, who we had the most robust Latin program in New York State. It was the Latin club was over was hundreds of was at least 135, 150 kids every year. It was a very popular program because she was like just an incredible teacher. And so she was there. And then our rabbi came as well. And our rabbi was a remarkable man and a very progressive, thoughtful, respectful rabbi and a really, really great
storyteller.
Yeah. Yeah, just a great guy and an excellent storyteller. And so the two of them were at the event. And when we got to the point for the audience Q&A, at the very, very end of the Q&A, my rabbi raises his hand and he says, you know, I see this is a book. He's walking across the country. It's a story of a pilgrimage and wandering. And clearly your Jewish upbringing was an influence.
Do you remember on your bar mitzvah when you had to read from the Talmud and speak? Was it that part? Was it Leviticus?
I started the event by saying, this feels like my second bar mitzvah. It was filled with like, you know, my hometown people, my parents, friends, all that kind of stuff. And so he started by saying, you know, you mentioned this is your second bar mitzvah. I'm going to hearken back to your first bar mitzvah. And so he was like, clearly you were inspired in writing this because it's these long walks by your Jewish upbringing. And so then my Latin teacher raises her hand and says, you know, this long walk is really reminiscent of Odysseus and Aeneas, all of the works that we read in your Latin class. And the two of them start going back and forth as to what my influences were. When
you're
it comes
like, no,
to-
no, it was me. It was me. When he did Pliny the Elder.
Pliny the Elder came up that night.
It always comes up. I took Latin. My Latin teachers were very nice. When I went to college, it was so funny because my brother, Russ, he was like, you're going to get retro credits. You won't have to take any language in college if you take fifth semester Latin in your first semester of college. And so I went and I was talking, when I went and visited my, I love my Latin teacher, Ms. Pierce. And so it, I went back to visit her after I started college, and I told her I was taking fifth semester Latin. She almost burst into tears because she said, "Jackie, you're not good at Latin." And I was like, "Oh, right."
I burst into tears that I'm following this pursuit that you taught me could go really, really positively too.
This wasn't one of the, you just like the idea of knowing Latin. It's much like the idea of writing a novel, which I've always wanted to do. It's a lot of work to learn. And I've actually wanted to go take Latin recently just to, because I think I would have the discipline.
Jackie, if you wanted to do like a little Latin class when I get back to Los Angeles in a couple months, I am down to take a Latin class.
Oh, you want to go to the community college? Because we could just go to Valley College and
that. Or I could, my Latin teacher retired a couple of years ago and she is Jones into
private lessons.
I'm sure we could set it up. She's awesome. She's like a
oh my god.
Yeah.
We'll
offline about this, but this is a real thing.
We'll discuss. Yes, very exciting. Okay, so is he walking? Now, I definitely want to get back to the pedestrianism just because I have so many questions, even though, of course, we've made it off so many times. But so Mr. Weston, this is during the Civil War, you said?
It's in the Civil War era, yes. So I touch upon it. It's because I am not a historian and will never purport to be. Within the scope of my book, I Walker learns a lot about his great great grandfather's legacy through letters that were written, and I do mention in those letters, like, you know, I was bounding through Nashua down to through Pennsylvania, because he goes from New Hampshire down to D.C. in the book, the original pedestrian that is based on all of these previous pedestrians, and he explains, he's like, "You know that there's a war going on? You know that there's something happening down here? Like, I hope it doesn't interfere with my walk, because I don't want traffic on the way." So yeah, this was a part of it. And there were pedestrians who would meet the presidents and Lincoln was aware of pedestrianism and Grant. And it was a part of the fabric of American culture at the time, because there was no pedestrian. There was no spectator sports. There was no.
That's nothing so weird. I mean, excuse me. Because they must have been races, like people were watching horse races, but they weren't like organized, right? I mean, it wasn't like, "Hey, everybody." Instead, it was, "Hey, there's going to be some punching. There's going to be a boxing match. There's going to be a curricle, but." The tiny chariot, but...
Oh, sure. Yes, I know what you're talking about. Yes. And then,
you know that word? I don't know how to say that word.
I always call it harness racing.
Yeah.
Because I'm not right. Because I...
Right. Exactly. Horse in a harness.
That's what they call it up in Saratoga.
That's right there at the track.
Exactly. Where I will be on January 8th at Northshire Books at 6 p.m.,
January 8th, right? January 8th, there you go.
With Shire Books in Saratoga.
Nice work.
Thank you.
Yeah, find Sam Pasternak and ask him about his upbringing. No, did this ever make you want to, like, in LA, there's a lot of people who hike. And my buddy Andrew Solmson hikes 7 hours a day. He's an IT guy, so he can, and he's such an IT guy, he can actually fix your computer with his phone while in a good reception area on Runyon Canyon.
Wow.
So remotely, but it is one of his favorite things is to walk. And he is moved by the scenery. He enjoys seeing all the dogs and all the people but he just walks like 7 hours a day. And what have you been inspired at all? Did you ever walk as a kid or did you ever?
I've walked from time to time. No, I, I, there's the great thing about this book, the themes of this book in walking is that, you know, it's all about movement. We've all gone somewhere. We've all moved in some way and in some capacity from A to B, whether it be with our 2 feet or otherwise. For me, I can't stand hiking. I am so not a fan of, I love a nature walk, but if it involves hills or anything precarious, I am out. I am terrified.
Right.
Like even Runyon, like there's spots of Runyon where you got to kind of like shimmy a little bit to go up up a little hill. I'm out. I'm so out on that. Yeah. But I grew up in the suburbs of New York and in Manhattan when I was a young kid and then moved to Manhattan after college. I was constantly, I'm obsessed with walking over doing anything else. And so I've always been that way to get from A to B. And that's
because New York City itself is a walking city.
Exactly.
And
so, I grew up with my parents. And then when I lived in the city, I was living with my 99-year-old grandfather. He was a massive walker into his 90s. He used to walk 50 blocks a day. And he was constantly walking. And the reason I think that this book really kind of subliminally, or subconsciously really excited me about this is he used to brag he used to have pride in other people when they would walk the length of the city of Manhattan. He used to say things to me like, you know, my friend Bruce, he walked from Wall Street up to Washington Heights.
A common thing of New Yorkers are just like, so this, you know, I mean, you could walk there. And you're like, sure. And people often get mad at me in New York that because it always takes me like 3 or 4 days to relearn the subway system.
Sure.
And it's when I run out of money. It's because I'm just like, what if I just take a cab? And my friend Jenny Bergman, who grew up in New York, is always like, it's faster to take the subway. It is faster. It is cheaper. It is all the things, Jackie, to take the subway than it is to take a cab. But I'm like, well, I'm going to mostly walk. And she's like, you will not. and she's like, we went up to the, you know, the Cloisters
up
up high.
Yep.
And she was like, now, and she always lived on, in her grandmother's old apartment, rent controlled, on 86th and Amsterdam.
Right near where I am right now.
Oh, there you go. Yep. You know, I always go to the fish, on 86th in Amsterdam. I'm spacing the name of the restaurant.
This is something that I should definitely know.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The CVS, the church that is in constant renovation.
Oh, Nice Matin?
No.
It's the CVS.
Someone is shouting at their radio right now. And they have the best white fish. They have it's fish.
Oh, Barney Greengrass.
Barney Greengrass.
Oh my God! When you say fish, I'm picturing like a filleted thing. That's why
like a sushi or something.
Yeah, I love Barney Greengrass. That's my whole childhood. One of the greats.
Well, I'm sure it's your childhood. It's especially if you're anywhere sort of up there. And but she's Upper West Side person. But I was like, well, can we walk back from the Cloisters back down to Jenny owns a toy store that her mom started called West Side Kids. You know West Side Kids, maybe.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, 84. On the Upper West Side. Oh my God. Yeah, of course. Oh my God, that's so funny.
And but she was like, no, we're not walking. And this was because the first time I went to New York, I visited her and it was in 84 and it was before the gentrification of Times Square and all the things.
When New York
New York, here's the thing. And I'm sure it's still like this in many parts is because one of my favorite things about Los Angeles is that much like New York in the 80s and the 70s, you could find all of these tiny stores that were privately owned, that people were like, I will rent you 200 square feet and you will get to sell whatever you want out of that 200 square feet.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, that is defined by a strip mall. There are strip malls everywhere in Los Angeles and they are amazing. If you find, when I find a new strip mall, I like to use all the parts of the strip mall, much like the Native Americans and the buffalo.
I used to live next door to the 8000 Sunset Strip Mall at next to the Laugh Factory. You know, the big one with.
Oh,
the,
right.
Yeah, I was.
Well, that's a huge strip mall.
It's a big strip mall. Yeah, there's AMC there, Starbucks there. There's a Trader Joe's there, CVS. It's like you can live in that strip mall.
Oh, you could live in that strip mall.
Yeah.
My favorite strip mall is on Coldwater and Magnolia, and only because. And this isn't true because what it has is it has one thing. And so I've tried to use everything except for the Krav Maga. I never took that. And, but they're that's where my nail salon is. And, there's a donut shop I go to. I once got my hair cut for $17. That was an error. That was in that same mall because it was fun. I was like, well, I want to use all the parts. And there's a Chinese restaurant there that I won't do just because I'm a snob about Chinese food because I worked at a Chinese restaurant in college. And, it reminds me of in Wisconsin, Chinese food is often a buffet and there's pudding. And that is, I don't want any part of it. So anyway, but I do love to walk and I may look into pedestrianism because when I think of British pedestrianism, I think of like a walking stick because the C.S. Lewis book Out of the Silent Planet, he's not only a philologist, he's a walker.
Mm. So then, so, yeah.
And he's on that. That's what made me think of it, I think.
One of the conversations I've had recently about the, I feel like you'll appreciate this as an LA person. I was talking to our mutual friend, Matt Kirshen, who's wonderful,
yes,
about pedestrianism. And we were talking about the UK version of pedestrianism. And he was telling me, he was like, oh, so they would walk to John O'Groats. And I immediately became so deeply confused because that's a diner in like Culver City. It's like
old. Yeah, thing. I knew I'd heard the name before.
Yeah, and so he's explaining to me you walk from John O'Groats to wherever the hell in Hampshire.
Okay.
And I'm immediately I'm not going to do a good job of making up British town.
Right, right.
Hampshire Fire is I think what I was trying to say.
The real, yes.
That's right. But he explained to me that John O'Groats is also the name of, and probably where the diner got its name, the furthest point in the UK, the corneriest corner. And so
yes.
I became deeply confused very, very quickly.
Right. Yeah. You're like, you went from a diner to to another diner?
You went from a diner to England?
Did you have to do laps on the boat?
This is exactly.
Heel toe.
you got to follow it. And this is, I was a marching band kid through college. And so heel, toe, toe,
you
heel.
You're so welcome here in the Dork Forest. Oh my gosh. The marching band is one of my favorite episodes of the Dork Forest is the guy who was a trombone player who also fixes brass instruments as one of his side jobs.
Oh, I love that. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I
lives in Chicago. Yeah.
I have spent so much of my time in music stores. One of my best friends is fourth generation of the Sam Ash family, and those the stores just closed recently. But when they were open, we used to just spend so much time in those stores, just kid in a candy store, every single instrument you could think of there. I was obsessed, and I was a drummer, but in marching band. But I was an arranger too. I used to arrange all the pop tunes for all the marching band stuff.
Oh, yeah. My friend, Stefan Zerowitz, he wrote a piece for our graduation. It was the mariachi band. And it was ridiculous. He created a mariachi band and wrote mariachi music for our graduation in the middle of the most Whitey Magoo factory town in Wisconsin. And
this is who there should be a statue of in your town is the man who makes the
Stefan Zegarowitz for sure. Yeah. Are you kidding me? Yeah. And yes. Well, here's the thing, Sam Pasternak. It has been an hour and I have taken up most of it, but in
not true at all.
That,
my God, come on now.
Everyone should get Sam Pasternak's book if you enjoy a novel of walking. Essentially, if you liked Road to Cairo or whatever that Bob Hope Bing Crosby movie, the series, I own them all on DVD. And he will not watch them. He thinks that they're too slapsticky for him. And I'm like, well, you're incorrect, but also correct. So Sam Pasternak, it's called Walker. And there, if you follow him on Instagram and all the things, Blue Sky probably. And
I'm on Blue Sky, I'm on Threads, I'm on Instagram. I'm not on TikTok yet. Someday.
Okay. Someday. Or not. Are you kidding me? I'm on Snapchat. And love that for me. And but yeah, get the book and follow him and find out if he's doing like a book signing near you. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Jackie, I'm so glad I got to do this with you. This was so fun. And I'll just say, I know I mentioned this to you in an email, but when I first moved to LA, I was invited to a comedy brunch that you were doing. And we met super briefly there. And it was like the first welcome to LA moment I had when I got out there. So thank you for that. And thank you for this episode. And I'm so glad we got to hang.
That's so great. And we'll do it again. And Rangers, you know the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?